Hey, it's Tony and Jenny Brewski from Real Ghost Stories Online. If you like this show, please consider helping us keep it on the air by becoming an EPP, that's an extra podcast person. You get a ton of bonus episodes and a brand new one every single week and exclusive video content as well.
It's only $5 a month and you can sign up at realghoststoriesonline.com.
Without our EPPs, this show could not go on, and our expenses to keep the show going continue to go up. So if you like it and you want it to continue into the future, please consider signing up at realghoststoriesonline.com. Get all of those exclusives. I can guarantee you will absolutely love them.
Thanks for helping keep Real Ghost Stories Online on the air.
If you're already an EPP, thank you so much for the support. If you're not and you've been thinking about signing up, please do so now and allow us to continue to do this show for you every single day. Sign up to be an EPP on the website, realghoststoriesonline.com. And thank you so much for the support.
Welcome to Real Ghost Stories Online. Call in your real ghost story now at 855-853-4802 or write in at realghoststoriesonline.com. You're about to enter the world of the unknown and quite possibly the undead. This is Real Ghost Stories Online.
And on today's episode of Real Ghost Stories Online, quite a treat for all of us. Joshua P. Warren joining us for a conversation about ghost hunting and some of the adventures he has been on. We're going to talk about how to hunt ghosts. We're going to talk about Haunted Asheville, the Pink Lady, and we're also going to talk about the infamous Robert the Doll, one of the most, if not the most, haunted doll out there in the world. He had some exclusive access to it, more so than most anyone has ever had. We're going to hear about what happened when he worked with Robert the Doll from beyond the glass case which it's stored in. It's quite a show, folks. Joshua P. Warren joining us today on Real Ghost Stories Online. My name is Tony Brewski. Josh, thank you for joining us.
Hey, thank you, Tony. Wonderful to be here.
And we're excited to have you. And you have been the author of several books on the paranormal. I would imagine some would refer to you as somewhat of an expert on the topic, as much as anyone in the living realm can be an expert on the topic. Knowledgeable, I think, is more so, you know, the key term, as we seem to constantly be learning more and more about it. I'd love to talk to you today about several of your books and some of the things that you've uncovered. I'd like to begin with one of your earlier books that you wrote a while back. And of course, people can check these out through your website, and we'll put the link up on our website at realghoststoriesonline.com. And that goes back to how to hunt ghosts. It's a topic that we talk about quite a bit on this show. We primarily hear ghost stories from people, not necessarily folks out there hunting them. But people are always very curious about, how do you hunt a ghost? Is there a correct way to hunt a ghost? So let's just begin there and start talking about ghosts, hunting ghosts, things you've experienced with ghosts. And let me just start out with a very broad question. What is a ghost to you, Josh?
Sure. Well, you know, I had to struggle with that question when writing How to Hunt Ghosts. And to be very technically specific, I think the best definition I was able to come up with is that a ghost is some paranormal aspect of the mental form and or physical presence that appears to exist apart from the original physical form. And I know that is kind of a laborious definition, but it's necessary in order to capture all the different kinds of experiences that people refer to when they talk about ghosts.
Mm-hmm. I would completely agree.
And of course, sometimes, you know, a ghost is something that seems sort of unpredictable and interactive, like an entity or a living spirit that's disembodied. And in other cases, it just seems like we're talking about an imprint or something that's redundant and very predictable and, you know, has sort of the essence of something that's kind of trapped in the environment that replays itself. I kind of think of it as maybe the comparison of walking into a restaurant in Hollywood and meeting Harrison Ford and shaking his hand and talking to him versus walking into a theater and seeing Harrison Ford up there on the movie screen. The version that you met in person is the entity, but when you see him on screen with the fedora and the bullwhip, that's the imprint. And so people, they are often unsure at first if they're seeing an entity or an imprint, which causes a lot of confusion in this very mysterious world we are exploring.
An imprint, that's an interesting way of talking about this. That's something I haven't really thought of. Is that kind of along the line of like a residual haunting, as some would say?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
A residual or an imprint type haunting is some kind of a phenomenon at a location that is special because either something very dramatic or powerful has happened that kind of burned an imprint into the environment, or there's something about that spot that allows people to perceive events that occurred in the past more easily. The cause and effect is obviously strange when you're dealing with these mysterious things, but I kind of feel like that maybe our environments are capable of storing information to some extent everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like when you go to, say, Walmart and you buy a product that has a little tag on it called an RFID chip. Now, these things are passive, but when you walk out the door, the electrical field from the security system hits those sensors, and suddenly it awakens them, it activates them, and they send a signal back. And so I think maybe the world around us is kind of packed with storage cells similar to those passive RFID chips. There's all this information sitting around us. But sometimes certain people are able to go into these areas and kind of shine their consciousness onto these areas properly at a certain frequency, and it kind of activates them, and they start sending information from the past back. And that's why certain people are capable of seeing these things at certain places better than others. It has to do with that relationship between the individual and the environment.
What's really interesting about that whole thought process is if it's an imprint or a residual haunting, the person or the entity that someone is seeing, or the imprint of someone that they're seeing as a ghost, if you will, doesn't necessarily need to be dead then for that experience to occur. In fact, couldn't the very same individual see their own imprint if everything lined up correctly, essentially seeing their own ghost?
You're absolutely correct. In fact, what they call ghosts of the living is a whole category of ghostly phenomena. And, of course, that's when you have people talking about possibly encountering a doppelganger, doubles. And also we have these very strange things called tulpas, which seem to be thought forms from living people that take on their own kind of external existence. So we have, for example, certain cases where authors have been haunted by the fictional characters they created. Walter Gibson was one of those people. He wrote dozens of novels with the character The Shadow back in the 1920s, and he was just churning out those novels with great intensity very quickly. And it seems that for years after that, people were haunted by the fictional characters in that house. They would see the shadow darting down a hallway or a villain running around a corner. And just recently on my own radio program, I played a recording that was made in the 1950s of an author named William Dudley Pelley, who also claimed that a fictional character he created was apparently sort of haunting him, and that psychic people could see this character easily. So indeed, we are talking about something that is not limited only to the energy from people who are now deceased.
What an interesting concept of something being created and essentially taking on its own energy and mind, if you will. Do you think that some of that could be not necessarily maybe something that's created, and this, of course, is all theory, but not necessarily that's been created by someone's imagination and then put into a book, but could it be one of the darker entities that we see out there essentially taking the form of something that is recognizable to its viewers, and then they're going to think, oh, this is from that book, and this is all it is. It's fairly harmless. It was just made up by a man, but really it's something else, just like a dark entity or a demon taking on the form of a child looking for help.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, these things could sort of shape-shift and morph into all kinds of different forms.
Sure. And it's one of those questions where we'll never really know the answer to, but it's interesting to discuss, if you will. So going back to the topic of how to hunt ghosts, is this something that the average individual out there who thinks, hey, I got something going on in my house, my cats are staring at the wall quite a bit, you know, sometimes the cabinet door opens, just, you know, things here and there that are questionable that seem to be unexplained going on. Is that something that the average person should try and investigate themselves as a ghost hunter? Is that a safe idea?
Oh, yeah, I think it's very safe. In fact, what you'll find is that most of the time there is a normal explanation. The reason we call these things paranormal is that they don't usually happen. And, of course, one might get the impression these days from watching so many TV programs or you know, reading books that people are just seeing ghosts left and right every day. It's not actually that common. I mean, I've been traveling the world and very actively pursuing ghostly phenomena for almost 25 years, and I've only had a handful of, you know, really striking, undeniable experiences with ghosts. But I will say, yes, I have a lot of scientific equipment. The kind of stuff that you often see on TV, the different kind of meters to detect electromagnetic anomalies and electrostatic anomalies and infrared cameras and ultraviolet film and all this kind of stuff. However, on my website, joshuapwarren.com, I have a book. It's a PDF, actually, you can download, called The Poor Man's Paranormal. And I wrote this book specifically for people who don't really want to go out and invest in all this technology, but they want to try to document some of the things that might be spooky or ghostly or paranormal in their homes. And so this book, The Poor Man's Paranormal, teaches you how to take very simple household items, things you probably have in your home right now, and use them to actually do a decent job of getting some at least preliminary documentation of things that are truly paranormal. And so there are many different levels that you can sort of begin working with. But the first thing is to rule out what's normal, what's ordinary, before you start jumping to the conclusion that what you're dealing with is something paranormal.
What are some of the simple tools that someone could use around their home to try and determine this?
Well, you know, one of the things that most people have somewhere is a compass. Of course, a compass should always point north. And if it doesn't, well, then there is some kind of a strange field that is affecting it, disturbing it. If it starts to point away from north or it spins, I mean, you're either near a magnet or some other type of field. And suddenly, you know, if the compass starts behaving erratically and you can't figure out why, that might be an indication that something unusual is manifesting. Also, you can take a fluorescent light bulb around your house with it, especially when it's dark. And you want to hold that fluorescent light bulb in the middle where the glass is and leave the ends open, exposed to the air.
Okay.
And if that bulb starts to flicker in your hand, even though it's not connected to any electrical source, well, that means there's some kind of a field, probably an electrostatic field there, that is making that bulb light up in your hand. You can use a simple AM radio to pick up different types of disturbances, background static. There are lots of things that you can use to document not only ghosts, but also UFOs, cryptids, all that stuff is in that guide. And
okay.
So I tell people, you know, that's a very good place to start. And also on my website, I have a whole section of photographs and video images that I've selected myself that I think are some of the very best, most clear, reliable images all throughout history of real ghosts. And so it's important to look at those when you're trying to analyze your photos, because people often will jump to pretty outrageous conclusions when they're trying to find a ghost in a photograph.
Sure. When you're out there ghost hunting, if you will, are you on a mission to simply try and be a viewer, if you will, and capture something on their own path with what they're doing? Or are you out there trying to actually interact with the undead?
Well, you know, for years in the very beginning, I was just trying to just to document it to see if there was any reality there or not.
Mm-hmm.
Once I finally had enough personal experiences and enough data to convince me that these things are real, well, then from there, I have gone into a variety of scenarios where I've attempted contact. I have never achieved, you know, that holy grail, just a clear, reliable, consistent sort of telephone to the other side. But I have certainly had experiences where something that was conscious was obviously interacting with me. So I have no doubt that these disembodied spirits do exist.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we have a long way to go, though, when it comes to some reliable communication. And plus, we don't know how long one of these spirits is capable of sticking around.
Sure.
These are all questions that we're exploring.
What's your take on some of the equipment that's out there now? Where, for example, is it the spirit box that uses the AM radio and scans the frequencies to try and piece together words and such? And things of that nature. Do you feel that those are reliable sources of trying to communicate?
No, I don't think we have any reliable sources.
No.
And I've looked at all those devices and technologies, and certainly these are creative attempts. I admire the attempts that are being made, and sometimes these boxes will produce words at moments that just make the hair stand up on the back of your neck, and it
sure
seems like more than coincidence.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem is, you know, consistency, and none of these things are consistently accurate.
Sure. Well, let me ask you this, because I know you're someone who's been involved with the production of several of the reality ghost shows as a guest and such on things like Travel Channel and such. And I myself was on Travel Channel a couple of years back on a food show, of all things. I was a host and judge on one. And you know as well as I how overly produced things can be on television. What's your take on a lot of the ghost shows out there? We don't have to talk specific shows or anything like that, but how is it, and how can a ghost show consistently and reliably produce content the way that they do that seems to be so undisputable as far as them capturing paranormal entities as compared to the real world and real ghost hunters who are out there? Who, you know, it's not every time you go out, you're getting ghosts and spirits. How is it that a television show seems to always be getting ghosts and spirits?
Yeah, that is a great point. And you know, like you said, I worked on many, many TV productions.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't take what I see on TV very seriously at all.
Sure.
You know, when you are in a situation where you are working on a deadline, but you better find a ghost, you know, if you want to get paid this week.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, there's enormous pressure.
Sure.
On these people who are in positions of talent. And naturally, they are going to exaggerate as much as they can.
Yeah.
Any little thing they get. And, of course, creative editing is commonplace. So, you know, I think that it's one of those, it's almost a paradox, because it's sort of like this activity is special and we're interested in it because it's rare.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, how are you going to make a show where it's happening all the time and preserve what's special about it? They've kind of painted themselves in a corner there. And so I definitely, you know, only view that kind of stuff as entertainment.
Because, sure.
You know, it just, and not to mention the fact you can't usually move a whole TV production crew into an environment without dramatically changing that environment. So there are a lot of problems with the way that the shows have to be produced,
sure,
given this kind of subject matter.
It's kind of a shame because just the sheer amount of encounters they seem to have, you have to go, okay, how many of these are real, how many are not? And when they actually do have one that is, in fact, you know, pretty impressive, it doesn't necessarily get the attention that it would, because it's just kind of globbed in there with all the other ones that are like, oh, yes, we caught this too. So the real ones are difficult to stand out, and you never know what is what.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And, you know, that's why, to me, there has always been a very distinct difference, mm-hmm, between research and business.
Sure.
Especially when it comes to show business.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when I go out on my own, I do the closest I can to pure research.
Sure.
But then when I'm called to work on a TV production or something like that, I realize, okay, we're just going to make a show, mm-hmm, and ultimately, I don't get to edit these things most of the time, and you just have to just take it with a grain of salt,
yeah,
hope it turns out okay.
You're playing a role. It's like you're acting a little bit, you know, for that specific case. Let's talk a little bit about Haunted Asheville a little bit, and let's talk about the Pink Lady. Tell us about who the Pink Lady is and the lore that surrounds the Pink Lady.
Sure. Well, you know, I was born and raised in the mountains of Asheville, North Carolina. In fact, those are the highest mountains east of the Mississippi and the oldest mountains in North America, with plenty of amazing ghost stories and myths and legends and things that really inspired my imagination. And one of the most famous ghosts in the area is that of the Pink Lady. Now, the most venerable historic resort in Asheville is called the Grove Park Inn. And the Grove Park Inn was built in 1913, and for, gosh, something like 70 years, they did their best to keep the secret of the Pink Lady because they were afraid it would frighten guests away. Apparently, sometime in the late teens or early 20s, a beautiful young woman in a pink gown was found dead in an area of the hotel called the Palm Court, below a balcony. So it appeared that she'd gone over the balcony. Nobody knew exactly what happened, if she was pushed or if it was an accident or a suicide. But there's always been speculation that she may have been a lady of the night, which, mm-hmm, you know, because there were a lot of wealthy people there who were able to conduct their affairs in private. And so we don't know exactly who she was, but over the years, people have continued seeing this woman floating around the hotel in this pink gown, sometimes appearing in guests' rooms at night, even tickling their feet and doing odd things like that. And I was the first person who was ever actually officially hired to go in, investigate the Pink Lady phenomenon, and write a report about it to see, you know, if there was anything truly tangible there. So the hotel hired me. I spent about 6 months doing that research, interviewing people, spending the night on this vast property. And finally, you know, the tide had turned and the world had changed. And so having a ghost became a good thing for marketing. And they decided to start publicizing the Pink Lady. And so now, you know, children enjoy going there, and they'll leave letters outside of the haunted room, like they're writing letters to Santa Claus. And it's amazing to think of, you know, how differently that sort of thing is perceived. But sometimes, you know, people will come up to me at my museum there in Asheville, North Carolina, and they will just share with me stories that still to this day give me goosebumps about things that they encounter in their rooms there at night.
What were some of the more disturbing stories that you've heard of the Pink Lady?
Well, you know, here's one that happened just recently that really stood out in my mind. There was a lady who came up to me, of course, and I wrote a book called Haunted Asheville,
mm-hmm,
which was the very first book of Asheville ghost stories ever published, and this was published about 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And now there are ghost tours, and I operate a ghost tour company there, Haunted Asheville Ghost Tours, and this lady came on the ghost tour, and she said that She was staying at the Grove Park Inn. She came into town initially with a conference, and she had never been to Grove Park. She had never heard of the Pink Lady, and just so happened that she was given room 545, which is one of the most haunted rooms there. And so she arrived late. She ran into her room, literally threw her luggage down, dolled up as quickly as she could, and rushed out the door to a dinner. When she got back from dinner 2 hours later, and mind you, she was staying by herself, she walked into her room, and everything looked as she had left it, except her camera, her digital camera, was turned on the bed. And she thought, oh no, I hope I haven't run the battery down on the camera. So she went over and picked the camera up and discovered that a photograph had been taken of the interior of her room during the time she was gone. And the photograph was taken from the ceiling looking down at the room, an angle that would be impossible for a human to accomplish. Mm-hmm. And, wow, just imagining how that happened is pretty freaky.
Yeah. Yeah, just slightly. That sounds like, did she stay in the room the rest of the night, or did she say, okay, I might need to go over to the Days Inn, please?
She stayed there. You know, some people, they don't want to do it. I mean, even I myself, you know, I'm happy to go into a haunted house and check it out, but even I don't want to go to sleep in a haunted room. I mean, I've done it, but I don't like the idea that I could just open my eyes in the middle of the night with some figure standing there, you know, when you're absolutely vulnerable and and surprised. So I don't blame people for requesting to be moved, but what you find that nowadays, because of the way our culture is viewing ghosts, people go there and specifically request 545, and there are, you know, around Halloween, good luck probably even booking that room because it gets booked in advance. So, you know, it's just, it's funny how differently it is still viewed to this day by some people.
Mm-hmm. Very, very, very interesting. So would you consider Asheville to be quite, I mean, obviously there probably takes more than one building to be haunted to have a ghost tour going on. Is it quite a haunted area?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Asheville is extremely haunted. For one thing, you have some of the purest quartz crystal in the world found there in those mountains. Even NASA goes there and uses the quartz for optics. And, you know, people may know that quartz has a very strange relationship with electricity. You apply pressure to quartz, it produces electricity. Or if you apply electricity to quartz, it vibrates. And what we have found time and time again is when ghosts materialize, we find these unusual electromagnetic frequencies and fields in these areas at the time of the manifestation. We're unsure to this day about cause and effect, you know, the chicken or the egg. Does the ghost appear and create these fields, or are these fields present and that allows some way for us to interface with the ghost? We don't know, but the fields are a component. And so when you have an area with this kind of mineralization, it gives you, I think, a boost to paranormal activity. That's one reason we may have action there. Also, Asheville is aligned with a lot of very other haunted and strange paranormal sites. I mean, if you draw a line east from Asheville and you go through the state of North Carolina, you hit all kinds of things, the Brown Mountain Lights, and a place called the Devil's Tramping Ground. You finally get to the coast where so many ships have sunk, they call it the Graveyard of the Atlantic. If you continue that line off the coast, you hit Roanoke, which was the very first colony the English set up in 1590. All those colonists disappeared, so it is to this day known as the Lost Colony. And then you continue drawing that line, and you finally hit the island of Bermuda, one of the top points of the so-called Bermuda Triangle.
Mm-hmm.
And then from just a historic standpoint, you also have some very turbulent history in those mountains for a number of reasons, not least of which being what happened during the Civil War. North Carolina lost more soldiers during the Civil War than any other southern state. Just recently, Virginia has contested that a little bit. But even though North Carolina lost so many soldiers fighting for the Confederacy, the governor of North Carolina actually favored unionism. And so North Carolina was in a very strange position politically, and it was a very, very messy sort of location where there were a lot of mixed feelings, and that created a lot of extra drama. So you have all kinds of different reasons. You could just go on and on as to why Asheville, North Carolina in particular, would be a very haunted place.
So I take it paranormal and ghosts are something you were somewhat surrounded with growing up.
Yeah, absolutely. As a matter of fact, my family on both sides have been in that area for hundreds of years. And so, you know, these sort of old pioneer experiences got passed along to me. And when, I mean, there were things that would happen to my family because my mother was one of 10 children. My father was one of 7. So with these big families, you know, you have a lot of experiences that people were reporting with all kinds of odd things. And as a matter of fact, before I was born, I had a great uncle named Claude Calloway who came back from a small game hunting trip and was photographed by my grandmother. At that time, she was a kid. And when the photograph developed, her older brother Claude did not have a head. And they couldn't figure out, you know, optically how that had happened. Well, 1 month later, Claude was on the porch of the house reading a copy of his favorite magazine, Western magazine, old Gunslinger Tales, and he was just having a conversation through an open window with his father. And at one point, Claude didn't respond, and they went outside, and here's his magazine on the porch. Where did Claude go? Well, my great uncle Claude was never seen again. He literally vanished in mid-sentence, as if he'd just been spirited away. It was a big tragedy, as you can imagine, in my family because they never had any closure.
Yeah,
and it seemed like his fate was sort of foretold just 1 month before in this phantom photograph.
It's almost like the Back to the Future photo, where the photos, the people start disappearing out of them, and then, oh, they never existed in the alternate reality.
Yeah, that's a very good point, good way of looking at it. And so you can imagine something like that.
Yeah.
You know, that really charged my imagination, and I wondered growing up, like, you know, are there other dimensions? Are there, you know, ways that these sort of fates, these doomed fates can be foretold? And so, you know, it made me really start exploring these things. And I started writing articles published in the local newspaper before I could even drive when I was about like 15. You know, my mom would drive me around and I would write articles about all these haunted places. And, you know, here we are like 25 years later and I'm still doing it. So
when you've been out there investigating these things in Asheville and in other areas, has there ever been a case where you just said, okay, that's something I'm not going to investigate any further? And not because you didn't believe it, but because you didn't want to get too close to it.
Yes. There was a case in Lancaster, South Carolina. And South Carolina is just an extremely haunted place for a number of reasons. I mean, it's played a major role in every conflict that the United States has been in. That's also where about 90%+ of the slaves were brought when they were brought to the United States. They were brought through South Carolina. And so there's a lot of haunted activity in South Carolina. Well, this farm was being plagued by all kinds of dark, terrible stuff. The fires spontaneously erupting, people getting sick, animals dropping dead. The woman who owned the place, she warned me, you know, she said, I'd like to have some help, but, you know, I have to warn you that bad things often happen to people when they come here.
Mm-hmm.
So understanding that, nonetheless, I went there with a team. There were probably about 8-10 of us. And one of the ladies on our team was a lady I'd never actually met before that night, but we had been corresponding, and she lived not too far away from the location. Healthy lady in her early 40s. She was a self-made millionaire and did ghost investigation for fun. Mm-hmm. And we investigated that house, and afterward that night, after she got home, she called one of the members of our team, and she said, "I've been to a lot of haunted places," and she says, "I've never really been scared, but I'm scared to death because something followed me back from that farm in Lancaster." She says, "It's a big, dark form," and she says, "He's floating around my house, and I'm here alone, and I don't know what to do." Well, finally, the member that she called calmed her down and said, "You know, let's touch base tomorrow morning." Mm-hmm. Well, the next morning, she was dead.
Oh, God.
And, that's as cold, hard, you know, reality as it gets. And there was never a clear consensus on what happened to her, because apparently it appeared that she had died violently, but there was no evidence that there was anybody around. And so I never went back to that place. And so, you know, I think that there are times when you have to face the fact that, scientifically speaking, there is no reason to believe that life has to only exist on this plane that we call physical.
Sure.
It's very egocentric of us to think that. There are beings that live on planes that are outside of our usual daily experience, and some of them are not good. Some of them have bad intentions, and sometimes you can get hurt.
Believe that, because this kind of goes back to the question of how many different types of ghosts there are, and it seems the ghostly family tree just gets larger and larger the more that we learn about it and discuss it here on the show, that there is a plane of ghosts that were people who walked the earth. Some of them were good, some of them were bad, and you can certainly have a nefarious or evil person that is a ghost, but not necessarily a demon, but just a very bad person that's a ghost. And then there seems to be another whole other realm of not so good ghosts out there that were never human beings that walked the earth.
Yeah, that's right. Those things that, you know, people often call demonic, for mm-hmm. example, you know, these appear to be parasitic beings. So essentially, they tend to latch on to a particular person and sort of gradually suck the life force out of that individual and gradually kills them is what usually happens, either by making that person ill or by making that person insane so that that person does what amounts to suicidal things. Mm-hmm. The parasite eventually kills the host. So these are kind of like spiritual parasites that will latch onto you, and the best thing you can do to avoid being victimized is really just to stay healthy physically and mentally. I mean, all the steps that you would take to avoid getting a cold mm-hmm. would help you. You know, being nutritious and having a strong body, those things will help you to preserve yourself, because your physical body and your energy body are connected. But you know, obviously faith is important. No matter what you have faith in, you have to have some sort of strength of mind, because these things are trying to attack you on a mental plane. And you can be weakened from many different angles.
They do seem to attack people who are in a vulnerable state more so than those who are not, from the stories that we get here on the show. And it seems like if someone's having difficulty with whatever it may be, whether it be some mental issues or physical issues, that almost seems to be the attracting factor sometimes for these things to go to them or to draw them to them.
Yeah, that's right. You know, it's sort of like, you know, usually they go for the low-hanging fruit, you know. That's mm-hmm. like kids are vulnerable and people who don't have a lot of direction in life, they can be easily swayed. And also, I mean, you can just put substances into your body that kind of open you up
sure.
and make you vulnerable to things that are ultimately bad for you. I mean, that's why, you know, we have such problems with people using, you know, different types of drugs and or you know, drinking too much or whatever it is that kind of opens some people up to these forces that take them down what ends up being a spiral of self-destruction.
Sure. Let's talk about Robert the Doll. This is something that you've researched quite a bit. You've even put a book out there on it, and you can get that through your website at joshuapwarren.com. Why don't you give us the backstory on Robert the Doll?
Why, sure. You know, Robert the Doll is, in my opinion, the world's most haunted doll.
Okay.
His history is quite impressive. He is over 100 years old, and he lives, I think it's safe to say, at the East Fort Martello Museum in Key West, Florida. And Robert the Doll is rather large. He is about 3 feet tall. He looks like a little sailor. He's wearing a little sailor hat, and he's holding a stuffed lion in his hands, and he's generally seen sitting in a rocking chair. The story behind Robert is that he was created by the servant of a wealthy family in Key West. The servant was from Haiti, and she was the one who usually looked after the family's son. And the little boy's name was Robert Eugene Otto. And we don't know for sure, but the locals will tell you that this servant became very disgruntled with the family one day. And after that, she made this doll that was modeled on the little boy. Because the little boy, he was into sailors and sailing and maritime stuff. And one of his favorite things was to go to the zoo and see the lions. So she made this little doll of this little boy, so it's kind of like a big voodoo doll, really.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the little boy's name was Robert Eugene Otto, and so the doll was called Robert. To prevent confusion, however, I will hereafter refer to the doll as Robert and the little boy as Eugene.
Okay.
That's what a lot of people would call him, his middle name, Eugene or Gene. So as Gene grew up, he continued to obsess over this doll, even when he became a grown married man. It caused problems in his marriage because he was a successful artist and he had a nice big house, but he treated that doll better than he treated his wife. He made a little room for it with little custom made furniture, and his wife couldn't stand it. The locals will tell you that from time to time, his wife would appear in town with bruises, and people would say to him, "Gene, are you beating your wife?" And he would just kind of grin and say, "Robert did it." And that began this tradition, a blame it on Robert. And so after Eugene died, his wife moved out of the house, didn't even want to take that doll, left the doll in an abandoned house for years. The kids in the neighborhood would gather around at night and swore that they'd see his little figure, though, racing past the window upstairs. And over the years, when people would come in to caretake the property, they would say that Robert was coming to life, that, you know, whether he'd be rocking in his chair or crossing and uncrossing his legs, or in one case, one guy said that he was attacked in the middle of the night. These kind of stories kept coming in year after year until finally somebody donated Robert to the museum. And they claim that right after that he was donated, there was a hurricane that caused flooding in the area, and nobody could get to the museum for a few days. When they finally got to the museum, a lot of stuff was destroyed. But Robert the Doll was up in the rafters of the ceiling and bone dry.
Oh, God.
And nobody could figure out how he got up there. So over the years, people would go in there and take pictures of Robert, but if they did not ask his permission, bad things would happen to them. In fact, if you go there today to see Robert the Doll, you will find the walls plastered with hundreds of letters all around from people apologizing, asking for forgiveness because they didn't take it seriously. They took his picture, they got home, and bad things happened to them. And so there have been occasions where they have had parades, and they've taken Robert out and had blame it on Robert Day when they would let crowds insult him and jeer him and just cathartically release all of their pent-up frustrations onto the doll. So it's absorbed a lot of negative energy. And so the story of this doll is very rich and very amazing. And so I went down there to Key West and studied Robert the Doll and was given special access to him. And in my book, which you can download as a PDF at joshuapwarren.com, you'll see I discovered some pretty amazing things, especially since they took the glass case off of him, which they had not done in over 4 years, and I was able to really get in close contact with this doll. And that case, honestly, it convinced me that dolls can come to life. And before this, I didn't believe that. But, you know, here's what I learned from investigating Robert and other possessed possessions. Mm-hmm. Scientifically, we still can't even understand how that our physical bodies are animated by life. We don't know how the mind-body relationship functions. So if we can't even explain how our physical bodies are living, then how can we so quickly dismiss the possibility that other physical forms might also be capable of being animated with life temporarily from time to time? And I think that's certainly what has happened in the case with Robert the Haunted Doll. And that's why he has inspired a lot of people. In fact, the guy who wrote the script for Child's Play said that he heard about Robert the Doll when he came up with the idea for Chucky.
What did you find when you were using the 3D imaging technology on Robert?
Well, you know, I went down there with a whole barrage of equipment, including, as you mentioned, a 3D camera. And this is before digital 3D was even available. This is a film 3D camera. Mm-hmm. And when I photographed Robert, and I did ask his permission, I wasn't going to risk, you know, that. I took several rolls of film, and I have taken thousands and thousands of 3D pictures over my lifetime. And all but I think five of those pictures were absolutely wiped out. They were just white. There was nothing on them, and I cannot explain that, especially since the ones that developed were right in the middle of the roll. That was bizarre, but here's the thing that really shocked me the most. Of course, glass blocks out a large portion of UV light. Mm-hmm. And so all these years, with Robert being kept most of the time under a glass case, it was impossible for an investigator to shine a proper UV light on him to see what happened. And when they removed that glass case, they had a couple guys come out with big suction cups, like lifted this heavy case off. I had about an hour, I guess, to investigate Robert. And I turned on a powerful UV light. And when I did that, instantly, boom, a symbol appeared on his right sleeve that was only visible when exposed to UV light. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't figure out what this was at first. It looked kind of like a snowflake. Not as beautiful as a snowflake, but that was my first impression. But I took a bunch of pictures of this, of course. And then later when I started researching, I found what I believe is this symbol in an ancient book of black magic dating all the way back to Babylonian times. So I think that, you know, with all these years, when people kind of presumed or suspected that the family servant had a background in magic and had somehow cursed this doll or used this doll as a tool to curse the boy or the family, I think they were onto something, and that symbol for me, it proves a lot. I would love to know what it's made of, though, but they've never had him properly tested physically. I don't think he's ever even been x-rayed, and his caretakers are very, very particular about him. It's almost like anybody who gets into a position to become the caretaker of Robert the Doll starts to gradually become very obsessive about the doll. Mm-hmm. And so it's hard to get some proper testing done. But those are some of the things that I discovered when I went down there in person.
Did you have anything odd personally happen to you while studying Robert or after studying Robert?
Yes. I never actually saw Robert move.
Okay.
I will tell you, however, there were times where just my impression of his expression changed, which is an odd way of putting it. It's a very subtle thing. It could have just been my imagination, but I did, you know, there were times where it looked like he was frowning and times when he was smiling. But the weirdest stuff was you know, what happened right after. While I was down there in Key West, my wife was alone at our home in Asheville, and she had told me that the whole time that I was down there, weird things were happening at our house, that security alarm, which has an infrared sensor, was just going off all the time without explanation. We had all kinds of different electrical problems, electronic problems. After I got back from that investigation in Key West, we started to see a shadowy form around the house. The dogs would go nuts. I mean, this went on for, I would say, at least a month. And there were other, you know, weird things that happened. It's like, this is really not related directly to the ghost story, but when I was down there, I went into a museum that was dedicated to a shipwreck. It was the last thing I did before I left Key West. I went to this museum, and they had a display where you could put your hand through a hole in, I guess, a piece of, like, very strong, you know, bulletproof-type material, like, you know, some kind of glass-type mm-hmm. material. You could put your hand in there, and you could lift up a gold bar. I was not telling how many pounds this thing weighed, right? And then after that, they would give you a sticker that says, I lifted a bar of gold.
Sure.
And like 3 days after I was there, somebody stole that bar of gold.
Oh, God.
And I watched the security footage. And it's so weird. It's like a guy just walks up to that display case and just reaches in like magic and just takes this thing out. I don't know how he did it. I called the cops to get an update. It's an unsolved mystery. It's an unsolved crime. Now, again, does that relate to Robert the Doll? No, but it's just one of those, like, weird things that seemed to happen right around that point in time when I was doing that investigation. And you find that sometimes, that when you get involved into a really interesting, hot, kind of exciting paranormal case, all these bizarro things start happening in your life. It reminds me of, you know, the Mothman prophecies where, you know, one thing sucks you in, and then after that you start seeing this whole phantasmagoria stuff happen. And I think that's partly because when you get in the right mindset, you start creating a lot of these phenomena yourself. And, that shows you just how deep the mystery of the paranormal can run.
It really does. Do you believe Robert the Doll is something demonic?
No, I'm sure that there are people who would certainly disagree, but just from what I've researched, to be honest with you, I kind of feel sorry for the doll, as odd as that sounds, because, you know, there's no doubt that the doll was born out of some kind of negative situation.
Sure.
And then over the years, the doll has been exposed to the worst of society. I mean, imagine if this were a real child and
yeah.
we were parading this child to the street and everybody gets a turn, you know, at insulting or jeering or putting the kid down. I mean, imagine how that kid would turn out.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I kind of look at Robert as being maybe a victim of circumstance. And I don't think that what was put into him was evil. I think it's a reflection of the environment that he's been brought up in, so to speak.
He's like the slime from Ghostbusters 2. Just all of the negative energy, just all compiled there
yeah,
into that.
Yeah, there you go.
It's it really is kind of like that. I mean, and that does make sense. I mean, it almost could be, you know, Robert could be a vase, or he could be a hat, or he could be a ladder. It could be anything. But when you have that much energy or negativity surrounding you and put upon you or an object, it doesn't seem to be any wonder that it may be producing some of those negative results right back, or mirroring them right back to the people that end up going and interacting with him.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that is most interesting about ghost research is that it tends to indicate that objects are capable of storing a lot more information than we realize. And I use the word object very loosely, because I'm saying that in terms of a location or structures at the location, like a house, or, you know, it could be something that is as small and independent as a doll. And in fact, I think in 2005, around 10 years ago, I was hired to do a television special on TLC, the Learning Channel, and it was called Possessed Possessions. Mm-hmm. And this was going to air on, I believe, Halloween night. So it was kind of like an antiques roadshow for haunted and cursed items. Mm-hmm. The show was hosted by James Von Prague, the medium.
Sure.
And then they had a couple of ladies who were operating as psychics. And then they had me as the guy to come in with all the gadgets and gizmos and to try to be as technical as possible about, you know, measuring these things and seeing if there was anything weird about them. And so they opened the floodgates, and, I mean, hundreds of people came from all over the United States bringing, you know, like surgical tools from the Civil War, or, you know, one guy had a haunted hearse, or, you know, he had plenty of dolls and, you know, weapons and just stuff like that that people would bring in. And I got to be the first person to go in and scan all these things with these different pieces of equipment. And I discovered that, sure enough, in many cases, these objects would radiate energy fields that I could not explain.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of, you know, would drive me nuts, because, you know, you think there ought to be a very clear source for some kind of a pulsating electromagnetic field coming from a teddy bear. You know?
Sure.
And when you can't find that, it kind of drives you nuts. But I had to conclude that, yes, some of these objects, for whatever reason, they store these things up, and they can at very least send that signal out to certain people who can pick up on them. But in other cases, yeah, I think these objects kind of have a life of their own.
It's very, very interesting. Thank you so much, Joshua, for talking with us today. I could talk with you for several more hours, I'm sure, but we only have an hour for the show. But I'd love to have you back again as a guest in the future to talk more about some of the things you've experienced, some of your other books, and of course, more ghost stories.
Oh, you know, it's amazing how much we've covered, but it's been fun. So thanks for having me on, and I look forward to next time.
Thank you so much. Joshua P. Warren is his website. Check that out. The link will also be on our website at realghoststoriesonline.com. There you go. That does it. Josh Warren, our guest today. Again, thanks to Josh for talking with us about all of the many ghost adventures that he has been on. Very, very interesting show today. If you like our show, please consider supporting it, becoming an EPP. That's an extra podcast person. On the website, realghoststoriesonline.com, you get bonus content, bonus episodes of the show every single week sent to you, access to our archive of bonus material, exclusive video content, and more. Sign up on the website, realghoststoriesonline.com. And thank you in advance for supporting the show and helping to keep us on the air. Without that support, this show would go away. So please consider helping us out to keep it going. It's only $5 a month at realghoststoriesonline.com. Until next time, for Jenny Brewski, I'm Tony Brewski. Thanks for listening to another episode of Real Ghost Stories Online.